It's nice to be back today, Saatchi. And I'm particularly excited because today we have a special guest in our studio, which is Charlie Harper. Now, Charlie, for many of you who may have guessed because the title of this podcast is Rewilding, Charlie has come from Knepp Castle. That's Knepp with a K. If you want to look it up, double P. And he is the head gardener at Knepp and leading an amazing program of rewilding. And we are going to unpack that today and learn about it. I'm Fleur, and I'm joined by my co-host and longtime friend, Saatchi. We're second career landscape designers and bring our life experience and a fresh perspective to designing gardens.
And I'm Saatchi, and you're listening to the On Garden Design podcast, where we chat about what makes a garden great, and we try to inspire and make designing accessible to anyone interested in gardens.
So welcome, Charlie.
Welcome, Charlie.
We're thrilled to have you here from the UK.
Thank you very much.
And I think just to give our listeners a bit of an idea about what we're going to talk about, tell us a bit about yourself. How did you find yourself as head gardener at Knepp? What's your background and where are you from?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I have no idea how I found myself to be head gardener at Knepp. No, I sort of took an indirect path, which I think is a good thing. I actually trained as an architect. So I that was my main direction in life. But then I made a decision that wasn't the path that I wanted to take, and I sort of sidestepped into landscape. So I worked for landscape designer Tom Stuart Smith back in London, and I worked for him for a few years, and then got into plants in a really big way, and said to Tom, I need to take some time out and sort of learn my craft a little bit more. So I trained as a gardener. So I trained as a horticulturist, and I worked at gardens such as the Chelsea Physic Garden in London, and then studied on the Kew diploma, Royal Botanic Gardens Kew. And then I went back to Tom after that in a more sort of horticultural capacity, I think you could say. And it was working there, a lot of exciting projects, but one I was very aware of in the office, and that was the exciting project at Knepp, this big wall garden biodiversity experiment. And I wasn't the project lead, that was my colleague Honor, but I was involved in the planting, and I was just following it from the sidelines a bit, and then going and planting it up.
Great. Well, for our listeners who don't know anything about Knepp Castle and the grounds there, so tell us what you've started with, what the design project's been about, and then what your part of the horticultural experiment is.
Really, we're talking about the estate, which is about 3,500 acres, which is 1,400 hectares in West Sussex, so south of London, south of England. So the team at Knepp, or the owners, tried to diversify as much as they could. And then it got to the point where they thought, this isn't quite going to work. So they sold their farm machinery and sort of packed up farming. Really a big thing to happen.
The whole thing. Wow.
Yeah. So they had local farmers coming in to sort of see this sort of agricultural titan buy their machinery. And it was really quite a big thing. And inspired by similar projects on the continent of Europe, and one in particular, the Osvaldsplassen, which is a big rewilding project using an array of different grazing animals that were placed into the what's called the polders of sort of coastal Holland. Isabella Tree, who wrote about it in her book Wilding, which I thoroughly recommend. It's really in-depth, really fascinating, really captivating story about the project, and it's really why I was so interested in this project when it came into the office. I thoroughly recommend it. And Charlie Burrell, her husband, they decided to do something a bit different with the land, and that's when they embarked on rewilding. And it's been going for about 24 years now.
Oh, so it's a long-term project.
It is, very much. Oldest of its type in the UK.
Right. And so can you explain to us in a sort of a conceptual sense, what is rewilding? Because I'm sure it means many different things to many different people.
Yeah, it's a term that you hear more and more, and often, you know, used in lots of different contexts. But it does have a practical definition which we follow. And really, to try and sum it up, it is the, you know, bringing back natural process to the landscape, which certainly in Northern Europe, we humans have removed. Mm. Our landscapes are very highly fragmented. There are roads, cutting it all up, and it's either developed on or farmed on down in the south of England. We're thinking about, if you imagine large animals roaming through the landscape.
Yep.
I mean, we're talking, historically here.
Yeah.
Before humans came along and sort of put fences up and et cetera.
Yeah, okay. So you use the word processes. So, because immediately I think of rewilding, I was thinking about bringing back endemic species, whether it's fauna and flora. I'm hearing, though, you're using processes very specifically as opposed to, you know, the endemic things. Is that right?
I think that as a sort of general definition is very helpful because it's broad.
Yeah, okay.
But really it is letting an ecosystem function as it is meant to. And you know, that's not just animal disturbance, that's lots of different things. You know, I mean, thinking about the Australian landscape, there's a lot of this landscape is evolved to be burnt. You know, it responds to fire. These are all natural processes which the landscape, you know, responds to.
Actually, when listening to Tom Stewart Smith speak at the Landscapism Conference in Sydney, he introduced a little bit about NEP, and he was saying that the biodiversity efforts have been such that you have to rethink or you have to recarve the land itself because biodiversity can't happen on a flat paddock. And so can you talk a little bit about the inputs in terms of sort of land form and what you've created to have like different sort of almost ecosystems that become more back to the natural processes in that space?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is I suppose where we can transition to the garden and the experiment that we've got. Over 24 years of observing the wider rewilding project and, you know, the wider landscape, it has been sculpted by, you know, grazing animals. Really, they've been the main sort of drivers of natural processes within this project. You know, if you just left it, if you put a fence up around it and just left it, it would actually be quite sterile. You get the really dominant plants kind of smothering everything, and so you need things to keep mixing it up and keep the whole thing dynamic. Dynamic is a really key word. You know, ecosystems are always changing; they're always on the move. And so that's where, if you think in those terms and you bring it to the garden, that's where our slightly different management of the garden begins.
Can I just ask a question? Because I always thought that, and I don't know why I thought this, but wouldn't we want to be trying to reach some kind of equilibrium at some point? Like if you've got something dynamic all the time, isn't there a point, though, where you want a landscape almost to become, you know, settled?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, dynamic, I guess, implies maybe it sounds like it's all happening very quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's not. You know, nature's always on the move.
Yeah, yeah, that is very true. Things are always evolving.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's easy. As garden designers, as gardeners, we often think about, you know, gardens being sort of quite sort of quick things. We want to see results pretty quickly. But most of the time in nature, inverted commas, things take a while.
That's very true.
Yeah.
Very true. And probably something we all need to think about a bit more when we plant massively, densely to try and get an effect quickly.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, as we know as garden designers, there are certain instances where maybe that's required.
Yes.
That's true.
I'm sort of thinking in my mind, I'm sort of imagining meadowing and meadowing style gardens, which have become quite popular, I think. They're quite popular. Mm-hmm. And I think there's such a lot of input in managing a meadow garden in terms of editing out the bully species and trying to find that equilibrium. Is that a challenge that you're having in the gardens at NEP? Are you managing in that sort of intensity, or are you just letting the bullies take over and having that sense of natural process?
No, that's a really good question. I mean, what we've done, so sort of stepping back a little bit and transferring what I've been rambling on about in the wider aspect, we have sculpted the garden. You know, we've sort of rootled it like the pigs in the wider project. You know, it's very easy to try and sort of simplify it. It's actually, rewilding's complicated. But really, we've got now three dimensions. So we've got where we just had areas of lawn. It was actually a croquet lawn, most of the wall garden. Now we've got three dimensions, inspired by what we've seen out in the wider landscape. In the wider landscape, we've seen these mosaics of different habitats starting to emerge. So it's a really, and that's really, really interesting to think about in a garden context. If you can think about your garden as a mosaic of different habitats, then really you're kind of on your way to rewilding it.
So you've got almost like micro ecosystems happening within the one.
Exactly.
Right.
You're trying to, if you think about trying to provide as much opportunity for wildlife as you can, rather than having, you know, a whole garden of one thing.
Mm.
It really is dependent on size of garden and how much you can, you know, effectively do that. You know, you can even think about having a small size garden in, you know, like where I used to live in North London. We had a balcony and a load of plants up there, very small area, but it connected to next door and the, you know, the park down the road and all of the tree pits along the road. So it's you know, you can see
the gardens wildlife as being, corridors or the biodiversity corridors almost. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's really, I mean, that's why gardens are so exciting. The potential of gardens is so exciting because it all adds up and it all connects. So if you've got a small garden, you can do, I don't know, one thing. Next door will do something different. So it's a series of mosaics. But going back to your question about the plants that probably do a little bit too well for our liking, we weed quite a lot.
I was about to say, do you have weeds? Because we have weeds and they all come from Europe.
Europe, yeah. That is, yes, I've noticed. We get plants that blow in, and we keep an extensive record of all of those. And you can see the garden as a very unique ecosystem. We're talking about domestic context here. So that's another really clear distinction to make, is that we're not saying, in our context anyway, that this is pure ecological restoration. Gardens are usually seen as extension of the house. It's quite a unique context
here. Manipulated
landscapes. Yeah, exactly. And the key thing to state here is that the gardener is therefore the keystone species. So you really have, you have the ability to make it more or less biodiverse. And so we keep a record of all of the things that blow in, but we starting to learn, you know, the uses that these plants can provide, the opportunities they can provide for wildlife. So we get things that might flower really, you know, there might be a daisy flower, which would be, you know, very universally accessible nectar source, pollen source, or it could be something with a really deep taproot that might break up our clay, for example. Mm-hmm. So we see things for the roles that they can play for wildlife, but also the ecosystem services that they can provide for us, and we kind of grade them. So rather than sort of saying, right, we'll get that out because it's going to be a nuisance, we sort of think about it. Think, if is it something that, say, there might be a very unique larval insect relationship, for example. Quite a lot of our native butterflies and moths, the caterpillars, will only eat a specific plant. So if that pops up and generally is considered a weed, we'll acknowledge that that actually has a very important role to play in our ecosystem, and we'll sort of, we'll enjoy it. And if it's a real self-seeding nightmare, then we might even sort of snip off the seed heads just before they're about to pop. It's about sort of constant observation and seeing what we've got.
And challenging my view of weeds, Charlie. I'm starting to think I need to think about them differently.
Yeah, but it's
that's a really good sort of idea to dwell on for gardeners in any of, you know, really anywhere, not just Australia, but anywhere, because we're really trying to think about, you know, making our gardens more biodiverse, you know, attracting more pollinators, insects, you know, whatever. And we're quick to rip out the weeds, but perhaps it's better to have some weeds in there adding
diversity
and dynamic kind of ecology in the soil than not having them.
There is a very good paper I stumbled across a few days ago on the perspectives of rewilding in Australia.
I found the same paper as well.
You did.
Yeah.
And it's pretty interesting because it is such a unique landscape. There are sort of two branches of rewilding that it discusses, and that is trophic rewilding, which is kind of quite active, and that's thinking about putting, you know, predators on and, you know, putting predators back into the landscape. Crucially, in Australia, to control species like the red fox or the feral cat,
which
have a colossal impact upon smaller animals. And, you know, one of the examples that brings up, just as a good example, you know, the bilby.
Yeah.
And actually reduced digging by bilbies means that water and the landscape becomes less porous. And so it massively changes the way that vegetation grows and so on and so on. So there's a massive knockdown through the chain. So, yeah, it's complicated. But then there's also passive rewilding, which is kind of just letting the landscape get on with it, not so much thinking about chucking animals into the equation.
You're just describing two very different ways of approaching rewilding, a very active one and a much more passive one. So I'm hearing that NEP is a lot more active. Practically, other than recording weed species and really looking at what they do, what other things are you doing? And you've changed your topography effectively as well.
Yeah.
What other things are you actually doing to rewild?
So, as I said, rewilding is restoring natural processes to the landscape, having a natural process-led landscape to create mosaics of different habitats. Or another fun word that we like to use is kaleidoscope, because it's a mosaic. But crucially, as I said, ecosystems are always on the move. They're always sort of changing. And generally, as gardeners, what we like to do is fight that change. We like to have...
corral, you know, things into their place.
Yeah, we like things to be just as we want them all the time. And so it's
we can relate to that.
Yeah,
I love seeing hedges. Soldiers lined up on a parade ground.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Just like that, right?
Exactly. But, you know, there's room for that kind of more formal gardening in some instances. We've got NEP Castle, and we've got formal gardens around that. You know, it's, you know, a lot of hedging there, which we sort of clip into cloud prune forms, and really it's trying to keep it static. Which is, you know, we'll come on to addressing that in later years. But right now in the walled garden, that's the area of experimentation. So crucially, thinking about gardens as mosaics is really freeing, because it means that a lot of people get quite upset about rewilding, because they probably don't understand quite what it means, and they might find it a bit of a threat to their gardening sensibilities.
What you mean? Because it's messy, you mean?
Well, it's just different.
Okay, it's not unified, and it doesn't hit those design principles.
Yeah,
is that what you mean?
It is just you know, still gathering momentum, but people might see it as a threat to things that they've learned in the past. But seeing the garden crucially as a series of mosaics, it is very accessible, because it means that there's room for everything. So, you know, you might have areas of mown lawn, you might have areas of sort of a lawn cut at the next level up, and then you might have areas of long grass, then you might have, you know, flower borders, and then you might have clip hedging, and then you might have loose hedging, and all of those will offer different opportunities to wildlife. We have areas of really quite almost scalped lawn back home, because we know that there are sort of ground nesting insects that favour that kind of habitat. And also there are some areas of lawn where we have a pretty rare fungi that likes to form on closely grazed landscape. So crucially, it's like we're not telling anyone that what they're doing is wrong. I mean, I guess might draw the line at a liberal use of agrochemicals or horticemicals, or even sort of plastic lawn. just gonna mention
you.
That. Yeah. Yeah. But generally, if you think about gardens adding up as a series of mosaics, that is really quite interesting and quite liberating, because it means that there's no right answer or wrong answer. You know, it all forms part of a greater network.
It just it's fascinating, and the scale is sort of like doing my head in. I'm just wondering, like, you started off sort of architecture, design, then went to horticultural, study horticulture. But I'm hearing that a lot of the work that you must be leading is also as an entomologist, as a...
Oh, I wish.
As a botanist. Yeah. You know, how do you measure this biodiversity? How do you measure this sort of ecological success that's happening in the rewilding scene?
I want to be clear, I'm sort of still really a jack of all trades. There are some things I'd probably know more about, but entomology I have a very great interest in. But we get help from people that really know their stuff on these aspects. So we conducted a lot of baseline surveys before we did anything to the project, and that's really interesting and quite crucial if you're interested in gardening for biodiversity, because you need to know what you've got. So that you've got something to compare to as you go forward. You've got your baseline invertebrate population, say, the ones that you've identified at the start, and you can then go back using the same methodology to measure your invertebrate species, say, just as an example, as time goes on. So you can, and then generally that will be a good indicator, a good ecological marker of biodiversity as a whole, because it all fits into a big web. But we do get help with that. For the purposes of this scientific project.
I was about to say, I'm nodding because I'm a scientist originally by training. Yeah. So it's all logical, setting baselines, you know, making sure you've got controls and all sorts of things in place as well.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's a huge project to manage. I mean, how big is your team? And is your team sort of permanent employees or and these scientists that come and assist, are they volunteers or part of the whole kind of program?
Bit of a mix. We're a small team. We've got...
With a big job.
Yeah. I mean, it just... Because quite a lot of us are part-time and I'm split over a few different projects. We've got a three-acre market garden and we just built a new public landscape and we've got estate properties where we sort of do bits at. And so, you know, we're sort of pulled in multiple directions. But it works out just being over about two and a half people per week to do sort of orchards and meadows and the experiment and then houseplants and the formal gardens.
That seems like a very few people to do so much.
I think that's why Charlie looks so fit.
Yes, well, he sprints from project to project.
That's a lot of physical work.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
But then, you know, overall a market garden, we've got two exceptional growers who are full-time on that. So, yeah, I mean, we could always do with extra people, but we've got very brilliant ecologists available at NEP. Some are freelance and some are managed by our head ecologist, Penny Green, who is, you know, constant inspiration. Energy is highly infectious. But, yeah, for this pan species invertebrate survey, we brought in a real specialist. But it's all very well saying, oh, yes, we just pay for a real expert to come in and produce a report for us every 3 years. But there are certainly ways that you can do this yourself. And then we run a series of workshops with Kate Bradbury, who often appears on Gardener's World. She's an author and a wildlife gardener, to show people how they can measure biodiversity within their own gardens. There are very accessible ways. But we, I guess, wanted to go really deep and find out exactly what we had.
Fantastic.
I think that's quite exciting on this idea, like Kate Bradbury and what she's doing to sort of educate the everyday gardener, because I think intuitively all of us in our garden journey, we want to increase the biodiversity in our own backyards.
Yeah.
And having some tools like that of how to do it. And also hearing you speak about, you know, it could be the fungi that grows on that log in that part of the mosaic, and it could be the a spider that inhabits the grass in that part. You know, just getting that sense that there is no wrong or right way to do this, that the more you have in the mosaic concept, the better that your biodiversity is going to be, which is adding to the sort of bigger
mix. Just presenting as many opportunities as you can. It just massively raises the chance of something coming and
But that said, I think there's a real mind shift here as well. And, you know, like Fleur and I certainly belong to a number of Facebook groups around the local area, and you constantly have people saying, what's eating my, you know, what's this caterpillar that's eating my citrus, you know, and we know that it's a beautiful swallowtail butterfly and they've actually started declining in numbers because people keep killing the caterpillars. Ditto, we've got native Australian Christmas beetles, which are quite beautiful, come out in summer, but people are, you know, every time they find the larvae in the vegetable patch, they kill them or they give them to the magpies. And so the numbers again are declining. So there's a real mind shift that has to go on here around this is all part of the ecosystem and we need to leave it. You know, it's got a place and it's got a role. And I think that's something that's quite hard to give up if you're a gardener that's been trying to make your citrus tree look really nice and then all of a sudden it gets decimated.
Yeah.
That comes back, I think, to what I felt you were saying before about this pushback for people who just want to have the really neat structured gardens. And that's where this mindset changes. We've got to accept that in the seasonal change, there's this dynamicism. that's happening that we actually got to celebrate. So, you know, when our gardens die right off, you know, like it's sort of Canberra summers, it can be really harsh. A lot of our gardens die off and our really growth seasons are spring and autumn. Winter, of course, everything dies back as well. And so it's sort of changing your mindset to say the garden isn't a permanent static thing that's going to look beautiful all year. It's going to have its death throes and
ups
its
and downs,
new birth and life, and things come and go. So it's sort of really looking at how we can embrace that as a way of, you know, garden design and gardening.
Well, I mean, that is one of the, if you're trying to increase biodiversity as a whole, then you think about the garden as an ecosystem, and crucially, a good way for controlling pests and things that are eating your plants is that you bring in the predators for those pests.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is that by massively increasing the network,
you get the balance
then
right.
You get the balance.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're striving for that in our vegetable garden within the kitchen garden within the experiment by, you know, it's pretty diverse. A lot of people would say, why have you got lettuces which have bolted? The reason being because they are a very useful flower, and I'd rather have roots in the ground feeding that soil biome rather than having bare space if I haven't got anything to fill it with. You know, we're trying to get in the predators, things like the lacewings to eat the aphids and get this.
The lady beetles, they're always welcome.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Except the 21 spotted lady beetle or whatever, isn't it? He sits there and counts the spots. Yeah, but anyway, there's one of them that's a bad one.
Yes,
except it probably has a different role.
Yes, probably. Yeah. Probably.
It just, you know, it does the same thing, but occasionally it eats the old
That's right. I actually had another question. So going to the design elements of, you know, a garden, when you are doing something like a rewilding project, do you ever have a, I guess, an eye on the aesthetics? Because at the end of the day, a lot of our gardens are about their aesthetic value.
Yep.
So are we putting that completely aside, or how does it work?
No.
Right.
Absolutely not. And that's you know, that's really what distinguishes a garden. It's a domestic, context, and you know we. Yeah, we talked before this podcast interview about the COVID pandemic and about how therapeutic gardens could be. These are places that we use and enjoy. So it's a bit of a balance, but you know, you can couple aesthetics with ecological function very, very easily. And actually, you know, we like it to look beautiful, so that sometimes does guide some of our decisions. But you know, it's one of a few different approaches. But I think it's very important that people don't see rewilding about making a right old mess, because it's not about that. One of the things that we say when people come and see the garden, and they come and they will often say, you know, I'm a garden designer, but the client doesn't want a messy garden. You know, how can I reassure them? And actually, a good way of, you know, trying to demonstrate our approach is by, you know, referencing a paper written by a landscape psychologist called Joan Nassauer in the 1990s in North America. She wrote a paper called Messy Ecosystems, Orderly Frames. And really, the sort of buzz phrase to come out of that is cue to care. And it's the best way of explaining that is if you were to come to my garden and it was all overgrown and it looked like I hadn't been there for a long time, you'd go in there and you get that quite sort of guttural reaction where you might think, oh no, I don't like this very much at all. But if I was to mow a path around the edge or through the middle or put a rope fence around it or a sign saying this has been left for biodiversity's sake, then there's a cue to some care there. It's not neglect.
Mm.
And so we see the landscape and understand it very differently. So in the garden at NEP, we like those areas of calm. So we keep the paths pretty clear. Yeah, but also having areas of bare ground, especially in, we haven't talked about soil, but that's a really big part of it, because we use quite a lot of recycled building materials and sand and all of that to try and diversify the soil conditions as much as we can. So you've got topography and you've got different types of soil together. It means that it makes the whole area.
You know, I know we're getting towards the end of our time, but I just have to pick you up on that piece, because Tom just
dropped that bombshell.
That's a whole new conversation.
It has to be unpacked, because Tom Stewart Smith dropped this bombshell at the conference last week, and he told us that you're planting into like 150 to 200 mils of crushed concrete and sharp sand.
Yeah, deeper than that in places.
And he said that there was enough nutrients in those products for the plants to thrive. So just tell us a bit about how does that work?
Well, there we go. That's one of the really fascinating things, is that actually, you know, what is soil? It's a living thing. It's not just an inert mineral mix. And if you put plant roots into just about anything, providing they are not toxic, then you know they all start photosynthesizing. They'll start putting roots down, secreting sugars into the whatever they're growing in. And there's lots of microfauna in floating about all over the place that would just love to make use of that. And so we've got things like bacteria and fungi, It often is bacteria in the outset that start to make use of sugars, but then you start to get the fungi that come in and say, well, okay, I'll have those sugars and I'll extend your network and I'll extend your root network down into the subsoil. And so you start to have this living thing starting to emerge. And we did do baseline soil surveys in the materials that we put down. We looked at it under a microscope to determine kind of what the living soil biome was, living things were in there before we started. And so we can go back year on year to see all these little squiggly lines moving around the microscope slide to say, wow, there's protozoa, there's amoeba, there's all sorts of these things that we never even consider underneath our feet. But that is, without that, you'd get nothing.
The foundations of life.
And it's true. Mm. And it's like, it's not, you know, not really seen as sexy, really. No. But it so is. And it's like on what everything else depends upon. So, I guess the crushed building materials, so that's concrete, so that's brick, that's flint, from a farm building on the estate, rather than shipping it for landfill, which is generally what you do, just get someone to take it away, we crushed it up and we used it. So we're making use of resources that we had lying around. And we're not saying that everyone has to just get some concrete and crush it up and put it on their gardens. Crucially, that we're making use of the resources that we had available to us, rather than sending it to landfill or for some other use. But what that did is just create areas that are really harsh, really free draining, very impoverished, nutrient poor. But then, crucially, we've got the sticky clay as well, right. And we've got different ratios: so subsoil, topsoil, sand, this crushed building material, and in different ratios. So it means that you've got that spectrum of soil richness
contributing to the mosaic.
Exactly right. Mm. So if you imagine coupling that with the topography, no square meter should be much like the one next door. So that means we've got, I should have said, we started with about 150 types of plant growing in this wall garden. Now we've got a 1,000. You know, so quite a jump. And the reason being is that we're providing as wide a range of conditions as possible, so we can grow different types of plants that are from really dry climates, that, you know, if they were growing in our clay, they'd die over winter because they'd drown and they'd rot off. But they are actually kept really free draining through a whole lot of crushed up farm building.
That's amazing. One final question, which is more about, because you sort of blew us away with your architecture and horticulture and all sorts of, you know, amazing qualifications at the beginning. Do you have any words of wisdom that you'd like to share with our listeners about gardens and garden design? Any key things that we should be thinking about?
I do, actually. And this is something that I need to adhere to as well, and that is, don't be afraid to fail.
Brilliant.
Because that's how you learn. And, you know, we're experimenting all the time. We're not saying this is the silver bullet, but it's exciting and we're seeing positive things happen. Some things go right and look amazing, and some things don't go quite as we planned. And that is just part of it. Just, if you imagine, nothing in nature is uniform and perfect. I mean, it is perfect. Nature is perfect. But, you know, there are some things...
When you use it, it doesn't always turn out perfectly.
No.
Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, some plants die.
Yeah, that's right.
And with death comes opportunities for other life forms. And, you know, if anyone tells you that nothing ever dies, or they're lying.
So it even happens to you.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so you've just got to learn from it.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. You know, you've been listening to a wonderful explanation by head gardener at NEP, Charlie Harper, which has just given, I think, our listeners, well, even us anyway, we're so excited.
Lots of food for thought.
Lots of food for thought, lots of different techniques, and just the courage to go forth and have a go. And don't be afraid to fail.
And learn from failure.
If you've enjoyed this episode as much as we have, buy us a coffee. You can do this through the link in the episode description or via our Insta and Facebook bios. Well, thank you so much, Charlie. It's been a delightful journey.
It sure has. Thank you so much. And
thanks for having me.
We will make sure that we put all those links up so that people can find the things. And hopefully this is the beginning of a journey for us in Australia as well, learning more about wilding and rewilding. Thanks so much, Charlie. We'll talk to you next time. Listeners, if you want to find us, you can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll talk to you again next time. See you later.
Bye for now.